right now, 52 degrees Kenosha, 50 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very happy to be sitting opposite Kaylin Palomares once again, who is naturalist and education manager at Hawthorne Hollow. And we're not going to say it every time, but we'll say it for the next couple of times. Kaylin is, in a sense, the new Nan Calvert, if there can be such a thing as a new Nan Calvert. Nan is, of course, irreplaceable, but Nan arranged for Kaylin to, in a sense, take over for the work that Nan had done here at WGTD for, I think we calculated, 18 years in terms of organizing on a monthly basis a morning show very specifically tied to something related to the natural world and the environment. And so this is Kaylin's second time now in this particular role. She's been on the morning show a number of times, actually, before that. And Kaylin has brought with her today on the morning show one of her colleagues on the staff at Hawthorne Hollow, ecologist Emily Leonard. And together we're going to be talking about a very important topic, and to mention Nan's name just one more time, probably the single topic nearest and dearest to her heart, native plants and the importance of eradicating invasive species as much as possible. And of course, that is of very, very significant importance at a beautiful place like Hawthorne Hollow. But it's also something that even homeowners need to be thinking about in their own yards and so on. It's something all of us need to be thinking about a whole lot more than we probably do. So that's the primary focus of our conversation today. So Kaylin Palomares, we welcome you back to the morning show. And for the first time, Emily Leonard, we welcome you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good to have all of you here. So Kaylin, before we go any further, let's just let our listeners know, for the sake of anybody listening who's not really acquainted with Hawthorne Hollow, exactly what Hawthorne Hollow is.
Hawthorne Hollow is a 90-acre nature sanctuary and arboretum. So we have 90 total acres of forests, prairies, wetlands. The Pike River runs right through the middle of the property. We have about 5 miles of hiking trails open to the public. We have an observatory, which is the largest public viewing telescope in southeastern Wisconsin, so that's very exciting. And then we have a 10-acre arboretum, which is essentially a museum of trees. And so there's over 200 different tree species in the arboretum, as well as, again, the forests have their own little biome of trees. But it's a nature center, and it's open to the public for educational programming and hiking and all sorts of amazing things. So,
and it has, of course, been around a long time, for more than half a century, I think. And maybe you could remind our listeners of the charming story of how it all began.
Well, Hawthorne Hollow was started by two sisters, Ruth and Margaret Teuscher. They were teachers, actually, up in Racine, and they originally purchased the property to go camping, and their dog had led them down what's now Old Mill Road on the one of our trails, and down to the river, and they fell in love with it, and that's why they decided to purchase that land. They used to camp down by the river where our amphitheater is now, and then after a while and after retiring, they decided that they wanted to live there full time. So then they built their home and their horse stable there, which is now our offices and our nature center. And our 10-acre arboretum was actually their horse pasture at the time. And they wanted that land to be protected, which was about 50 acres at the time. They wanted it to be protected for the future and to stay natural. And so it was kind of taken over by the Hyslop Foundation, which it still is today. And so since 1967, it has been open to the public as a nonprofit nature sanctuary.
Fantastic. And it's one of those things that it's close by. I mean, right between Kenosha and Racine, right there on Green Bay Road, and yet tucked away just enough so that when you drive down that driveway and into the heart of Hawthorne Hollow, you feel like you're a million miles away, which is just great to be so close and yet, in a sense, so very remote. Remind our listeners the work that you specifically do at Hawthorne Hollow.
That's a very loaded question, but generally, so I'm a naturalist, which essentially means an outdoor educator. So I'm educating the public, whether that's students, children, or adults and families about outdoor education. We also touch on heritage-based things there as well. So Native American history, American history, and culture. So I kind of touch on all of those things through field trips, programs for adults, and other events.
Very good. So you have brought one of your colleagues along, Emily Leonard. Emily, tell us about when you first came to Hawthorne Hollow.
Yeah, so I started at Hawthorne Hollow just shy of 2 years ago. I grew up in this area, so Pleasant Prairie, Kenosha area. So when I moved back to this part of Wisconsin, it was no question in my mind that I was going to be looking for work around this area. And I went back to Hawthorne Hollow a couple times on hikes and then discovered that they were hiring an ecologist there. So it just felt like it was kind of meant to be. When I started at Hawthorne Hollow, I kind of quickly learned that my role, like Kaylin's, would be to wear many hats. But that main hat for me is as the ecologist there.
Great. I'm anxious to find out exactly what it means to be an ecologist. It's one of those words we hear all the time, and yet most of us on the outside looking in don't, I think, have a very clear understanding of exactly what that encompasses. Before that, though, tell us a little bit about what I would assume to be is a pretty ferocious love of the outdoors and the natural world. How and where did that begin for you?
Yeah, I was just talking to my parents about this yesterday. So they were just down seeing the eclipse in totality, sending me pictures of snakes and butterflies and flowers that they were seeing down there. So, of course, it's obvious that it came initially from my parents. You know, we really spent a lot of time camping growing up. We would always visit the national parks and state parks. So I would say that that was kind of my origin story. But from there, I actually, when I attended my undergrad, so I went to Northland College. It's an environmental liberal arts college up in Ashland, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. When I initially started there, I thought I was going to go into sustainable community development. So I really cared about sustainability, so I thought that was the direction for me. But my first semester there, I took a botany class and a geology class and quickly switched gears, realized I was meant to go into the natural resources field. So I kind of pivoted toward that, which then a few years later led me to graduate school out at Utah State University.
So what would the degree have been called then that you ultimately secured?
Yeah, so my bachelor's degree is in, it's a bachelor's of science in natural resources and biology. And then my graduate degree is a master's degree in ecology.
Great. So take us inside that intriguing term, ecology and slash ecologist.
Yeah, sure. So it can mean a lot of different things. I think kind of at its core, it's someone who studies the natural world. So ecosystems, plants, animals, and kind of how they interact. I like to think of us as kind of the jack of all trades in the science world. So we kind of look back and learn a little bit about everything in a landscape rather than specializing like, say, an entomologist would do on one specific piece of the puzzle. But for me personally, I've kind of taken that interest into the restoration realm. So you might even call me a more of a restoration ecologist. I've done the research side of things, but now at this point in my career and in my life, I've gone definitely into more of the land management and restoration side.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, today is Kaylin Palomares's stint on the morning show for the month of April. And with her is one of her colleagues from the staff of Hawthorne Hollow, Emily Leonard, who is the staff ecologist. So before we delve into today's topic, you've both kind of talked about the wearing of many hats in terms of the work that you do at Hawthorne Hollow. Tell us a little more about that. I mean, you know, in a sense, why Hawthorne Hollow, in a sense, operates like that and the kind of different hats that you find yourselves wearing in your work.
Well, Hawthorne Hollow is a nonprofit, as I said earlier. And I think that within nonprofits, I've learned through even my short career so far in the field that nonprofits have a lot of that. And that's because there's a lot to do and not a lot of money or resources to do it. And so the people that you have are generally very, very dedicated and motivated individuals. And so they are going to be not only doing their own job, but they're also willing to help out with all other areas to make sure everything is running smoothly. And there's not always necessarily a dedicated person for one specific thing. So in my area, like, again, I prioritize education, and that's what I'm doing. But there is a lot of times where I'm out helping her doing some invasive species removal, or I have actually watched over a wedding ceremony because our wedding coordinator couldn't be there that day. And I have done trail maintenance work, which would generally be a grounds person job. So, and I think Emily has done, she helps me with field trips when I need an extra person because she has a history as a naturalist as well. And obviously she knows her stuff. So there's a lot of that. And I think that that's just kind of the atmosphere of a nonprofit, is everybody wants to get everything done and wants everything to run smoothly. And so we're all willing to help out in each other's areas where we can.
Sounds perfect. I mean, it sounds like the best working environment in which to be, at least if you're the kind of person who relishes those kinds of challenges. Well, speaking of challenges, one of the primary topics that we're going to be talking about is the scourge in so many environments of invasive species of one kind or another. So the eradication, or at least the limitation of invasive species, and then a term that we will explore a little bit later, namely habitat restoration, of trying to take a habitat and doing all we can to restore it more to its original and healthier state. But let's start with the bad news, start with the nasty, namely invasive species. We've talked about this, of course, a number of times on the morning show over the years, but it wouldn't hurt to start with kind of invasive species 101. Explain just kind of that concept. What is that? What are invasive species? What do they have to be to earn that moniker?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people think of invasive species as being non-native. I guess that isn't always exactly the case, though we might use a different term to describe a native that is aggressive. But at its core, an invasive species is just something that is occurring in an area where it doesn't belong, where it's kind of upsetting that natural ecosystem in some way. So it can be a plant where maybe that particular plant was moved here or brought here from a different country and has become very aggressive and kind of outcompetes our native vegetation for resources. So nutrients, water, sunlight, things of that nature, and space, of course. So typically they're pretty aggressive and will kind of take over an area. But invasive species also include animals as well. So insects, we have a number of invasive insects here in Wisconsin, but also occasionally mammals as well.
Mm. So just to circle back to your aside, which is really intriguing, in a sense, an invasive once in a while, once probably in a great while, could be native. I mean, it's something that wants to take over to the detriment of other natives. But most of the time, I would think the vast majority of the time, a being or a plant or an animal that can do that is typically going to be invasive.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think really good example of a native plant that becomes aggressive, I would probably use the term aggressive more than invasive in this sense, would be like if you have a wetland that's a new wetland restoration like the one we have at Hawthorne Hollow, and you start to see things like some cottonwood saplings that are popping up and taking over the area. Well, our cottonwoods, they're a native tree species. You know, we have them here and we're happy to have them here. But occasionally they become really happy and flourish in an area where we don't want them to. So we have to manage them as if we would a non-native invasive species.
Interesting. So explain what it is about an invasive species, that is a species that did not originate here or originate in this particular habitat. What is it about the fact that it comes from the outside that so often leads it to be aggressive in a really damaging way?
Yeah, so in a lot of cases, that species that is introduced didn't evolve with our wildlife here, our insects here, and our other plants here. So while they can flourish in certain settings, maybe they are generalists and can flourish anywhere and just happen to really like the spot where they landed. Or maybe they grew in wetlands in a different country, and when they occurred here in the U.S. or here in Wisconsin, they found that the conditions were really similar and started to take over. But a lot of our pollinators here specifically, and some of our bird species as well, have really grown accustomed to our native plant communities. And so I guess I'm speaking to the invasive plants rather than anything else at this moment. But it means that when that new species comes, it can really, really upset not just the other similar plants that might grow there, but the whole ecosystem.
Right. Probably one of the things we need to say right off the bat here is that although invasive species are something that are at least to an extent unwanted, we're not talking about something that's necessarily ugly or unattractive. In fact, that probably has little, if anything, to do with it. And that seems to me that's something we have to underscore, that once in a while when we're talking about, or maybe quite often when we're talking about an invasive species, it means cutting back something that looks perfectly pleasant, maybe even really pretty, but that doesn't mean that it's a good thing to have in that habitat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the things that were brought here were actually brought here for a reason. The people who lived here thought that it was a beautiful flower, maybe from where they moved from, or sometimes they bring it here for food, whether it be food for them or food for their livestock or other animals. So a lot of the time, people who intentionally move plants around have the best intentions.
So at a place like Hawthorne Hollow right now, what are we talking about in terms of the most pervasive and present natives that are causing some trouble or wreaking some havoc, if you will?
Yeah, so it definitely changes with the season. So at the beginning of a season, say right now, we're starting to see some of our spring invasive species popping up. So those would be things like garlic mustard, Dame's rocket, things that like to compete with our native spring ephemeral wildflowers. At least from the plant perspective. In terms of insects, we're constantly on the lookout for our Chinese mantis egg casings. So the Chinese mantis, everyone thinks a praying mantis is just the coolest thing, but they can definitely wreak havoc on a prairie or a wetland, right? So yeah, right now those are the main culprits, but then throughout the season that'll change to things like cutleaf teasel, Phragmites australis, which is common reed, which is a grass species, reed canary grass. The list could honestly go on and on in any category. Mm-hmm.
So as the ecologist at Hawthorne Hollow, what is your responsibility? I mean, like, are you the person primarily who's going out and just kind of assessing the situation, seeing what's there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the 90 acres is kind of my playground. I'm responsible for managing the 90 acres, of course, with help from people like Kaylin and really all of the staff and our summer technicians and interns as well. But it is my job to kind of recognize problems, identify solutions, and then actually have some boots on the ground projects to help us address invasive species on the property.
Right. So take us, for instance, into this current spring of 2024. First of all, as soon as it starts to sort of get nice out, I mean, are you already out there taking a look? I mean, at what point do you really become serious in terms of surveying the grounds and seeing what's going on?
Yeah, to be honest, it is a year-round problem. So sometimes if the conditions are right, I'm out there cutting buckthorn, which is an invasive shrub in Wisconsin, in this part of Wisconsin especially, in the winter, right? It just really depends on the best, or the weather, when I have the best conditions to work in. But this is really when things start to ramp up for me. You know, it's the growing season. So I'm out there every day kind of on my hands and knees pulling garlic mustard and Dame's Rocket in our woodlands, and definitely keeping an eye on some of those wetland invasives before our wetland native plants start to bloom.
Right. So how much has to do with, for instance, what kind of winter we've had or what kind of spring we've had? I mean, do those have particular effects on what really sort of rears its ugly or pretty head more than other particular invasives?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, for instance, this year, I'd say that I'm finding patches of garlic mustard that are about twice the size of what they were last April.
Wow.
So they've had a little, we've had a few more growing degree days, a few more days that are warmer, sunnier. The plants started growing a little earlier, despite the fact that we had a pretty cold March. So yeah, it definitely can vary year to year. And some years I see plants produce more seed. So some of our invasive plant species like buckthorn can have a mass seeding year. And that would be cyclical or dependent on weather and things like that as well.
Right. So when it comes to invasive plants and when you find them, and of course you're always finding them, then what happens? I mean, what is sort of the plan of attack? And it sounds like it's a relentless around the clock or throughout the calendar attack on your invasives. Typically, what is the response?
Yeah, so I think it's important to first determine if it's just like a one-off occurrence. So for example, I occasionally will just find small patches or individuals of what I would consider invasive species that haven't quite established yet. And we would call that like kind of a first response type of approach where you try to catch them in those early phases. Now, unfortunately, there are some times where you walk into a clearing or into a part of the property where you haven't been in a while and you see stands of teasel that have gone to seed, and it's years of work at that point. So you have to recognize when you're looking at like an understory of buckthorn or a field of teasel that that's not just a one-year project at that point. You have to, like you said, kind of be relentless, visit it year after year, reduce the seed that goes into the soil because those seeds will come back the next year, right? As well as kill the plants that are already there while also making sure that you aren't disruptive to maybe the native animals that are using that area and actually using those plants.
Wow. Yeah, this starts to get complicated.
It does.
You were mentioning that before we went on the air that that once in a while the animals, for instance, that are at Hawthorne Hollow will sometimes make use of these invasive species, even though it's maybe not the optimal diet for them, but they'll maybe do it out of necessity. And so just the sweeping eradication of everything, that can have some ramifications that you don't really want.
Yeah, absolutely. So very quickly, my graduate research was on Phragmites australis, which is an invasive species. And I was looking at arthropod communities, so largely insect communities, using those stands of Phragmites and comparing Phragmites stands assemblages to native vegetation. And we found that there really wasn't that much of a difference in terms of arthropods using Phragmites versus native plants. So from like a bird perspective, birds are also using those stands of Phragmites, songbirds that are nesting in them, for example. And then here at Hawthorne Hollow, I've been cutting teasel to find a small chorus frog using a teasel cup, bathing in some of the water that's collected in it. So you have to be aware that, you know, even though invasive species can be seen as enemy number one in a lot of cases, they are still being used by native wildlife as well.
Interesting. So take us into then the decisions that get made about what to do about the native, I'm sorry, the invasive species that you find. And again, right now we're talking about plants. We'll get to the whole matter of insects, which is kind of a different matter. But when it comes to invasive plants, then what guides the decisions that you make? And for instance, what kind of decisions have you already made this spring in terms of the invasives you're finding at Hawthorne Hollow?
Yeah, so there's a different prescription based on what you're dealing with. So some plants can be hand-pulled. That's kind of the best-case scenario where you can pull the entire plant and its root out of the ground, and that's it, right? Other times you have to cut a tree down or a shrub down, and in that case, sometimes it will re-sprout if you don't do more. So in that case, that would be an instance where we start to use herbicide. Now, I really try to not overuse herbicide. You know, no one wants to use herbicide. It's not exactly fun and not always the best for our environment. But in a lot of cases, when used appropriately, it is the best way to eradicate certain invasive plant species.
And does it vary from species to species in terms of what's going to work and what things are going to be resistant to?
Yes, absolutely. So again, like different prescription depending on the plant. So sometimes we would use one herbicide that is meant for broadleaf plants versus one herbicide that's a little bit more universal that we can use on a number of different types of plants, whether it be a broadleaf plant or a grass or even a tree or shrub. So it's, and then again, the amount, the frequency at which you have to treat it, or whether or not you need to use two different treatments combined. You just learn the plants over time and what works and what doesn't. And that's why long-term monitoring is really important following restoration.
Wow. Kaylin, as she's talking about this, I imagine, you know, your wheels are turning as someone who's on these trails a lot. How much are you involved in the, for instance, the detection of invasives, and how much are you also involved in the work of actually eradicating?
I have gotten to the point where I know that if I see it, Emily's probably seen it, because we for a while when she first started, we'd come and be like, I found this big patch of garlic mustard over by the bridge, over by this blah blah blah. And she's like, yeah, I know, I saw it.
Found it two weeks ago or whatever.
And so, and then that just probably stresses her out more. So she does have a map in the hallway now. So if we see poison ivy, if we see garlic mustard or something in an area, we will mark it on the map so that she's aware of it. And if it's already marked, then we know she already knows about it. So that's become kind of a good system for us. But any time that I'm out walking the trails, I'll make mental notes of, oh, that's not supposed to be there. Oh, I see something. Or if I just see one thing, I'll just yank it out and leave it to dry out. And that, depending on what it is, that works. And then I'm definitely not out there every day like Emily is, but when I can, when I have time, I am also out there. You know, we are chopping down buckthorn and treating the stems. We are cutting off seed heads from reed canary grass and all sorts of, and pulling garlic. Literally yesterday, I ran out of my office because I saw a possum, and I went to go chase it down and try to get a picture of it. And then we see Emily's pulling garlic mustard in the floodplain of the river. So then TJ and I walk over there and we start pulling a couple too. So it's very much a team effort, but Emily is definitely the sole leader of it.
Heart and soul. Yeah, no kidding. Emily, are there certain invasive plants that in a sense mimic, are there certain invasive plants that that mimic natives? I mean, that are tricky to identify, that you could easily misidentify?
I wouldn't say mimic exactly. There are definitely some that look similar and maybe occupy similar habitats. So one that I'm constantly pointing out to people is the difference between, say, gray dogwood and buckthorn, or some of our other native prairie shrubs and buckthorn, because they grow in similar habitats, they have a similar growth form, and to the untrained eye can really look similar. So we do have some native varieties of invasive species. So one that I think of a lot is our purple loosestrife. So purple loosestrife is an invasive wetland plant, or at least that's where it occurs at Hawthorne Hollow. And we also have a native loosestrife, fringed loosestrife, that also grows nearby. So it's a matter of recognizing that there are native varieties within the same potentially genus.
Wow. Yeah. That again makes it a little more complicated matter than we might think. So we're not just talking about invasive plants, but there are other invasives that also can cause some trouble. So explain maybe a few of those and what is to be done about that.
Yeah, I think the biggest one right now that people are probably pretty aware of in Wisconsin is the emerald ash borer. So less of an issue now, but about 10 years ago was really coming through and taking out all of our ash trees, so trees within the Fraxinus genus. So unfortunately for us, a lot of our roadside trees and shade trees in our urban areas were ash trees. But then also at Hawthorne Hollow, being a floodplain forest, we had loads of ash trees as well. So in areas like that, we've kind of left behind a lot of standing dead ash trees from this emerald ash borer, which is a non-native beetle that its larvae burrows under the bark of a tree and can kill that tree. So that's one. And then I'd say another insect that I mentioned briefly was the Chinese mantis. So the Chinese mantis, we do have a native praying mantis species here as well, and they kind of share habitats. But the Chinese mantis is a little bit more aggressive, will kill a lot of our native insects, and they also seem to be populating our prairies and wetlands pretty quickly, I've noticed over the years. So that would be another invasive insect to keep an eye out for. And then not here yet, but coming up, is the spotted lanternfly. So the spotted lanternfly is a serious issue elsewhere in the U.S., but not quite here in Wisconsin yet that we know of. So that's kind of an up-and-coming one that we want to keep an eye out for in our forests.
Right. So not to get too graphic here, but when you see a Chinese mantis, for instance, do you kill it? I mean, is that what you do when you find an invasive insect?
Yeah, so I kill their eggs. It's hard for me because I know that the best approach is to squish it. And that's actually a campaign that they're using for the spotted lanternfly, is like stomp it out is literally what they say, which I totally understand. And so for me, I tend to take kind of a proactive approach where I kill their eggs. So if I can find their eggs first, then I will try to kill the eggs so that we don't even have to deal with the adults. Now, of course, that's not always perfect, but I do often leave our prairies and wetlands with bouquets, literally sticks with the egg casings of praying mantises on them, and throw them into the fire.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, yeah, that's another way to do it. Is that it in terms of invasive species that are not plants? I mean, we're not talking about some kind of mammals or something that are also a problem?
Oh, I think that wild boar are going to become an issue in Wisconsin someday. So wild boar are an invasive species elsewhere in the U.S. right now, kind of working their way north. So I think that's something that we could maybe anticipate in the future in terms of wildlife. So,
Kaylin is making strange facial expressions over here. Have you had a bad experience with a wild boar?
It just stresses me out, because I think of that as something that people down in Texas maybe, or somewhere down south, would deal with. And she said that there's already been sightings in, western Wisconsin or northern Illinois, and that freaks me out. Just knowing that those could be around here, it's not something that you'd expect to see around here. And then, when I think of an invasive mammal, I think of cats. I'm a cat person. I have 4 cats of my own, love them to death. But cats can be a very invasive species, especially in neighborhoods where you have a lot of people trying to feed their songbirds, and there's not a lot of habitat to go around, and so they're confined to an area, and then the cats, outdoor cats, will go in. Yeah. We don't have that much of an issue. We've got one cat that hangs around. It's not ours at Hawthorne Hollow. We haven't seen it kill it. Maybe a chipmunk, but that's something that as someone who's not like involved as deeply as her, I think of that as an invasive mammal.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, anything that creates trouble, let's say. Yes, we just haven't all quite learned how to get along. So one of the things that I know you are anxious to sort of say today is that when it comes to the matter of invasive species, that this is not just something that the good people of Hawthorne Hollow should be worrying about, but this is something everybody should be thinking about, including in their own backyards and so on. So what is kind of the takeaway for people in terms of where they live, and what would you suggest that they do?
Yeah, absolutely. So two things. The first is just be careful of what you plant. Maybe do your research before you start planting plants in your yard, because a gorgeous Japanese barberry in your front yard might be nice for you, but those birds and other animals might be moving those seeds around, and that's how we end up with invasives, right? Mm. So they're just doing a little bit of research about what you plant, and whenever you can, choosing a native plant to plant in your yard now, or just at least something that you know isn't going to become aggressive or invasive, right?
Right. So, for instance, if you see a picture of something and you think, yeah, that would be pretty, should you Google the name of that plant, and are you likely to come up with warnings or caveats about if you make that particular choice?
Yeah, so they have lists of what is considered an invasive species in Wisconsin. So I think that's a great place to start, is just Googling the plant invasive Wisconsin, see what turns up. But then you could also call some local professionals, maybe someone here at Gateway, or, you know, you could always call me. Now, I don't want to have a bunch of calls, you know, my phone ringing off the hook at Hawthorne Hollow about this, but definitely there are different ways to find out whether or not that plant might be become invasive or maybe escape your yard.
Right. When people have invasives, what is your suggestion for them?
Yeah, so learning how to treat the invasives in your yard. Again, that could be a quick search or a Google search, but a lot of them can be hand-pulled. So if you have something like a thistle that is an invasive thistle, or say you have garlic mustard in your yard, those things can just be pulled as you see them, and that will help it from escaping your yard into your neighbor's yard, right? And if you are dealing with something a little bit harder to get rid of, say maybe Phragmites or buckthorn, and you're not sure how to deal with it with herbicides, there are definitely people you can call that do this type of work that would be happy to do it for you. So if you have a larger property, this is someone's job somewhere to help landowners deal with invasives on their property.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, today is Kaylin Polamaris's visit to the morning show, and with her today, a colleague from Hawthorne Hollow, Emily Leonard. So the last part of this conversation is about, in a sense, the positive flip side, and that is this notion of habitat restoration, of trying to restore a given habitat to something close to its original pristine state. Kaylin, you were saying that it's really important to understand that that's not a, you know, it's not a matter of you kill the invasives and then you plant all this nice stuff and there you go. It's not a one and done. Tell us, in fact, what the nature of habitat restoration is.
Well, I think Emily can probably explain how, you know, it's not, like you said, it's not a one and done. It's not just a, oh, I've decided one day that I'm going to do this. I don't know if you want to explain, like, kind of what that looks like from beginning to end.
Oh, sure. So briefly, I think that it's important that to understand that there are phases to any restoration. So there's usually a planning phase where you just kind of identify the problems and potential solutions or goals for a project, whether it's to create habitat or deal with erosion, whatever that restoration looks like to you. And then there's implementation, which is the actual boots on the ground, shovel-ready project where you're out there managing the invasives or manipulating the land. But I think the most important thing, and kind of hitting at that not one and done idea, is that the third phase, and arguably one of the most important phases, is continuing to monitor that site as it evolves and use kind of adaptive management to deal with new problems that might be arising or the evolution of that restoration project. So that's a big part of it. And I use kind of use more of a survey, long-term monitoring type of approach, where I do continuous surveys and monitor a site for several years following a restoration to understand how the needs of that restoration might have changed.
Right. So, for instance, at Hawthorne Hollow, where there you have 90 acres, right? So I assume with that much land, there are parts of Hawthorne Hollow that are not restored at all, where none of this habitat restoration has yet occurred. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of give us a rough idea of sort of the scale of what we're talking about?
Yeah, so I call those kind of no man's land spots, and they haunt my dreams. But I would say that there are definitely spots where maybe restoration has occurred, but not for several years. Like, for instance, we just burned our prairies for the first time in 11 years, which is not the fault of anyone other than just the nature of weather and time and capacity, right? Mm-hmm. So there are definitely, being one person or a small crew of people, we can't touch all 90 acres every year. So it's about prioritizing at that point. And some of our newer areas, like our new wetland restoration, is in a very vulnerable stage. So we want to prioritize our energy in some of those new restorations to maintain not only our investment, because restoration is expensive, but also that habitat that we created that the wildlife are now starting to depend on.
Right. So you kind of mentioned like different areas on the grounds of Hawthorne Hollow. So are there certain places that sort of, in a sense, sort of shape themselves, like, oh, there's this place over here and there's this place over there? I mean, as opposed to it just being a big sweeping 90 acres of, I mean, in a sense, are you almost talking about neighborhoods that you have on the grounds of Hawthorne Hollow, and what kind of determines that, yeah, this is going to be its own habitat, mm-hmm. with its own issues?
Yeah, I love that you use the word neighborhood, because that's what we used to teach kids, was that a habitat is nature's neighborhood, right? Wow. So you have these different neighborhoods, these different habitats. We have prairie, we have wetland, we have upland forest, we have our floodplain and like riparian area along the river. We have a mix of some even meadow, and then our arboretum, which is a whole different beast and managed in a different way. So we are not just one consistent habitat, though there's a lot of connectivity and overlap between those habitats.
So you mentioned that habitat restoration is expensive. What is the nature of the expenses that are incurred?
Yeah, so usually, at least the way that we approach it at Hawthorne Hollow, is a lot of our projects are grant funded. So we don't just have a pot of money sitting around to do restoration at any time. Occasionally, we have some funds for conservation, but typically you're applying for grants. And that grant money would cover everything from herbicide, if you're using it, to kind of the man or woman power behind the project. So hiring people or paying staff salary to do that project. And then plants and seeds are actually very expensive as well. So whether you're buying plugs or pre-grown out plants from a nursery to use in that restoration, or buying seed, you have to buy several, you know, sometimes depending on the area, hundreds of pounds of seeds. And that can really add up, because, you know, those seeds have to come from somewhere, and then that labor that goes into those seeds and plants as well.
Right. And what kind of goes into your decisions about what to plant in terms of native plants in a given area? Mm-hmm. And how big a mix are we going to talk about in a given habitat?
Yeah, that's a complex question, but I guess when you're deciding on what to plant, it's important to know what the conditions of that site are. So how much sunlight that area gets, how dry the soil is, and then also what wildlife would be using that area. So for instance, Kaylin and I have a project coming up where we're doing a pollinator garden, specifically trying to provide some food for hummingbirds, because we have hummingbirds, but they don't have a lot that they're feeding on right now. So we've kind of handpicked some plants that we, well, not handpicked, that's not, we have selected some plants to go into that site with that in mind specifically. So who will be using it, as well as what conditions are present at that site. And then, excuse me, when it comes to the seed mix, that is, again, similar to selecting plants and just knowing what would grow there. And then also there are lots of studies out there. So always referring back to the literature, because people have studied for a long time what density to plant these seeds at for the best success. And you're almost always overplanting, you're overshooting the plants that will actually grow in hopes that some more of those will take, because some will often get washed away or eaten by birds or insects. So it's important to kind of overseed some of these sites when you can afford to do so.
Right. Is it easy to find the seeds for planting native plants? I mean, are those readily available to ordinary citizens, for instance? Where do they have to look for this?
Yeah, so at the scale that we're talking about, we're lucky to have some seed providers in this region. So like Prairie Moon Nursery, for example, could be a great one. There are lots of others in this region. Or if you're buying plants, Johnson's Nursery, we actually have a really great connection and relationship with Johnson's, as well as several other. And Kaylin might even know some of our connections in that area more than I do in terms of where we've purchased native plants or trees for our arboretum. But these places are definitely open for the public to purchase from as well. There are native plant sales all over this region. They just had one up by me in Milwaukee. Kaylin, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. If you're ever curious about what's a plant or like where to get plants from, there are local Wild Ones chapters that Nan was a part of. I don't know if she still is. Mm-hmm. But those people are so knowledgeable, and they can help you, and they are willing to help you. And then they also do an annual plant sale. And so that hummingbird garden, we were actually grant funded by Wild Ones. Thank you guys for that hummingbird and pollinator garden. And so we were able to pick native plants, which come from a series of different native plant nurseries. So Prairie Moon, Prairie Nursery, it's a little confusing there, Possibility Place, things like that. But that is closed for this year, but those nurseries, you can still go to their direct website and you can order seeds, plants, plugs from them. And then there's also, on a more just homeowner level, you can go to your Steins or to your Milligers and you can find some native plants there. A lot of the ones that you will see will be cultivars, which is its own whole thing, where they are technically a native species, but they've been bred to be a certain color or be a little bit bigger. And so they're not technically fully native. They may or may not, depending on what they are, provide the same benefits to insects or birds who will be using it. But like, for instance, Steins, they have a whole section of native plants. Oh. And so I've gotten a lot for my own yard from there. And they are usually a decent deal. And the thing that you really have to worry about with places like that, though, is them using some sort of a pesticide on their plants. Sometimes they will spray their plants to keep bugs and another pests away. And that can affect, if you get a butterfly weed plant, for example, and you get monarch caterpillars eating it, then they could become poisoned. So the best case scenario is to get it from a native plant nursery. But if you can't necessarily do that, then you can find it at these other local type places.
Right. Great advice. Great. Well, what an interesting conversation this has been. We've ranged far and wide across a lot of important but all related topics, and I really appreciate this opportunity. Kaylin Palomares, great to have you here again. Thank you. And Emily Leonard, wonderful to meet you, ecologist at Hawthorne Hollow. Thanks for all the information that you've shared today, and we hope people will take it all to heart. So thanks again for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Kaylin, before we let you go, I know you have four announcements you want to make.
I do. So some upcoming environmentally related events and programs coming up. So this weekend on the 13th from 2 to 2:30, Bong State Recreation Area does a live animal encounter for any kiddos that want to go and learn more about. I believe that they do mostly reptiles, things like that, where you can go and hold them and learn about them. And that is free if you have a state park pass. You just have to be able to get into the park. So that's, again, this Saturday on the 13th from 2 to 3:30. Next weekend and the following week are popping in the area because it's about to be Earth Day and Arbor Day. So all the environmental places around here have stuff going on. So just to touch on a few, Carthage College is doing their sustainability summit on the 20th, next Saturday, from 8 to 4.
That is free and lunch is provided. That's a really cool event where speakers from all sorts of different environmentally related careers come in and talk about what they do. Emily will actually be there presenting. Oh. And I went 2 years ago, and it was very, very interesting, very amazing. Also, Gateway here at Gateway does their Earth Day celebration also next Saturday from 10 to 1. That's going to be here on the Kenosha campus, also on the Elkhorn campus. That's free. There's going to be river cleanups, arborist demos, and some other local organizations there with tables. And then Hawthorne Hollow, of course, is doing Earth Week. That is going to be taking place from Monday the 22nd, so that's Earth Day, through Saturday the 27th. There will be volunteer opportunities, an Arbor Day celebration, and free educational programs. So check out the Hawthorne Hollow website if you're interested in any of that.
Wonderful. Yes. So yes, we have all kinds of different ways we can celebrate Earth Day coming up, I think, on Monday the 22nd, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. Great. Kaylin, thank you for all of that, and we look forward to seeing you in the merry month of May.
Yes, thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, an interview related to the natural world, I reconnect with Cy Montgomery. And I spoke recently with her about a beautiful book about turtles, but her most recent book done with National Geographic is called Secrets of the Octopus. And indeed, the octopus is one of the most amazing creatures on Earth. And this beautiful book explores just some of the things that makes octopuses so incredible.